Thank you.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 2, 2009. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2489, 2490, and 2623, and ask Representative Cameron to testify first. Then we will go back and bring up witnesses in order. And Representative Shields.
Is that the first three bills?
Yes.
Okay. The fourth one's gone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be here. And yes, my motivation is pure, Mr. Yeah. Chair, as to why I'm putting these bills forward is that I do believe that we need to be strong on crime and that we need to do the right thing when people made poor decisions. But most people go and pay their dues, and we need to do everything we can to help those people be successful when they've completed their sentence and when they come out. And the series of bills that's before us today comes to you with a lot of thought. I serve on the governor's reentry task force on a statewide basis, and that's been a very good experience for me, and to hear some of the problems that we have with prisoners reentering into the normal life and some of the obstacles they face. And then also here in Marion County, we have a very active group, part of the meth task force that started here in Marion County has moved over and is dealing with reentry issues. And so these bills actually come from that Marion County task force on reentry programs. So with that, I know there's mutual support for many of these bills, and we're going to hear some testimony as to some problems with some of them, but also the reasons for them are the right reasons. So I'll stop and allow my colleague to share.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon House, District 43. Prior to becoming a legislator, I was the founding executive director of an organization called Better People that helped probationers and parolees, people who've been in recovery from addiction, change their lives and find living wage jobs. Representative Cameron asked me to join him in House Bill 2489, 2490, and 2623, and I just am here to say I wholeheartedly support the ideas behind these bills and appreciate him bringing them forward.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I guess I didn't identify myself for the record. Representative Kevin Cameron, House District 19, South Salem, Almsville, and Turner.
Thank you. I missed that.
Could I add one thing for
sure,
the
Sure. Yes, please.
I'm also one of the co-chairs for the Public Safety Subcommittee, and my being here in front of this committee testifying on these bills is not necessarily any indication that I would support them fiscally, but I'm here mostly as a state representative rather than as the co-chair of public safety.
Mr. Chair, I have one quick question.
Yes.
And
question.
I don't care which of you responds. On House Bill 2623, I just want to make sure I'm reading this correctly. Under Section 1, the little a, b, and c there, those are in the conjunctive, or is it the intent that it could be one or the other of those, or they all three have to be met? Thank you. I'm glad I wasn't the only one. I get.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stiegler, what line are you talking about here?
Okay, lines 8 through 13.
Okay.
And it's those subsections. Now, I'm reading them as they're set out here in the conjunctive so that they all would have to be met.
Yeah.
But I think maybe if the intent is that they be in the disjunctive, that it could be any one of these three?
The intent is that all three of them would be met.
Okay, conjunctively, all together.
Right.
Okay.
In other words, you have to have the appropriate behavior.
Okay, so they're conditioned on each other. Okay, cool. All right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stiegler, I I'm glad you brought that up. This deals with the appropriation of earned time, which I think
right.
is a little complicated, and I'm sure somebody from the department might be able to better explain it. I did want to also put on the record that the state of Washington has used earned time quite successfully in reducing recidivism, and they've the Washington Institute for Public Policy recently did a study showing that you can expand earned time credits and still protect public safety.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'll leave all three of the meeting, all three of the hearings open right now and call Gail Meyer next, please.
Members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like to open my remarks by thanking Representative Cameron and Shields for their work on these bills. It's a delight to see and know that reentry issues are being addressed, you know, by the legislature, and that there is sensitivity to the difficulty some of the inmates have in successful reentry. So we want to thank them and indicate that we do support all three bills, 2489, 2623, and 2490. And I would like to thank Representative Stiegler for her comments about the ands and the ors, and I would only like to pose the following thought. As to House Bill 2623, with the inclusion now of subsection C, which is on lines 11 and 13, I think we've now made it more difficult for an inmate to qualify for the earned reduction in the term of incarceration. So the proponents of the bill know exactly what their intent was, and I just wanted to clarify. Currently, as written, we have in there subsection A and subsection B, and that is an and.
Right.
And I question whether or not the intent is to simply leave that as one way of qualifying for reduction and then subsection C being a second independent way of qualifying for a reduction. We would encourage the latter.
Representative Burton.
Chair, I just want to add on for purpose of our discussion that I, too, when reading this bill last night, was confused by the conjunctive or disjunctive form, also actually in Section 2 as well. And so I guess when you have three lawyers who immediately zero in on the unclear, like that, I think we'll be, if we could take another stab at that somehow to try and clarify that, if possible, it would save us some headaches down the road.
Yeah, I'd second that. Just, and that's why, and you're right, when you read it with Section 2, then that created even more of a question mark in my mind. So, and I, you know, I just think we need to be clear because these are the areas where somewhere later on down the road when they're, you know, in statute and somebody goes to apply them, it's like, So, and I'm probably supportive either way. If the third is an alternative, I think if we can get them clarified, that would be good.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to go back up here? Or just
you can go ahead for where you are.
If I remember right now, in fact, if you look at the way it is worded in Section 2, it is good behavior and participation in an adult basic skills, good behavior and the diploma. So it would still, it wouldn't change the intent of the bill was not to change anything that was previously there and make it more difficult. It was to give another option to have good behavior and complete a GED or education program would be another option. So yeah, we need to clarify that up above, however we need to do that.
Right, because we use and, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I may. We use and in one, but or is used in two. So that was where I was,
Mr. Chair,
having issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative, a question of Representative Cameron, if I may. So to clarify, so the intent of the bill is to say Section A and either B or C. Is that correct?
Correct.
Gotcha.
Okay. We'll maybe get that fixed before we move that particular bill out. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Next I'll call David Rogers and Kimberly Elaine.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Rogers, and I'm the executive director of a statewide advocacy organization called Partnership for Safety and Justice. And just briefly, Partnership for Safety and Justice works to advocate for policies that make Oregon's approach to public safety not only more effective but also more just. And we're a fairly unique organization, not just to Oregon but really to the country, because we bring together all of the folks who are most impacted by the system. So that includes survivors of crime, people convicted of crime, and the families of both. And we do that because we think it gives us a holistic analysis of what kinds of system changes are needed. I'm here because I want to strongly advocate in support of the content of House Bill 2623. And just to say a few things about it, although I didn't give you written testimony, one thing that is being circulated is something that Representative Shields had mentioned, which is essentially the first page of a report that was released actually in November 2008, just a few months ago, from the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. It's a nonpartisan, government-funded research shop that is really based on helping to inform the Washington State legislature. And what you'll see is that essentially they've studied an increase of earned time that was passed in 2003. They've been studying it for the past 4 years. And what they found is really two things. Not only did the increase of earned time, the people who received that increase were less likely to recidivate, so it actually increased public safety, but it also saved the state millions of dollars in the process. And I think that we can find two things from the study. One is that when people are doing well on the inside, it's indicative that they're going to do well on the outside. And so the people who are likely to receive earned time, it's an indication that they've been working hard to transform themselves, like, for example, participating in educational programs. And so I think that the House Bill 2623 is really founded on solid research and what has been, and just our neighbors to the north have found, that really our approach to public safety not only needs strong accountability, but it also needs incentives for people to do well. And so that's the kind of classic carrot and stick approach. And so what's fantastic about House Bill 2623 is that it provides that carrot, it provides that incentive for people to use their time well when they're in the state prison, to engage in education programs which have been proven to help reduce future crime. Clearly, it's worth noting, too, that in this context, when we're looking at a projected $3 billion shortfall for next year, that engaging in not only smart public safety policy, but public safety policy that saves money in the short run and in the long run really seems to be policy that it serves both purposes. And we shouldn't be leaving any stone unturned in terms of potential savings. And so what's great about this is that the evidence suggests that it will not only increase public safety by reducing recidivism, but it should save money. The one last thing I'd say very quickly is that many of you have probably seen Craig Prinz, who's the executive director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, provide an overview of Oregon's public safety institutions and agencies. And one of the slides that is pretty stunning, which I imagine many of you have seen, is the slide where essentially he shows the amount of money that Oregon spends on just the debt service for past prison construction, and he compares that to what it is we spend on the types of programs inside prison that help reduce that are really rehabilitation oriented. And what you find is that the amount of money that we're spending on the debt service of past prison construction has been going up and up and up to the point where it's currently about $130 million in this biennium. And for the past 12 years, the amount of money that we've been spending on rehabilitation programs inside prison have been consistently cut. And it's disinvestment to the point where it's less than half of what we're spending on just debt service for past prison construction. that's a trend that doesn't bode well for our approach to public safety. And I think that we need to get smarter with our public safety dollars by actually investing in the types of program like adult basic education on the inside prison, investing in those programs, and also creating an incentive for people to participate. Because, again, that reduces recidivism, it increases public safety, and it actually saves the state money in the long run, which seems like a pretty good combination. So I appreciate your time.
Okay. In Washington, if I recall, and we've gone over these before, they lock up a lot of people for small amounts of narcotics that we don't do. So I don't know how many of these offenders, because it says nonviolent, are let out, or some of that big group of people who we don't lock up in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much a difference that would make. And while agree overall, but with the prison construction, you have to remember we didn't build prisons for many years, and crime was, in many people's opinion, a lot of the public's opinion who voted for some of those measures, needed new prisons. We needed prison beds. And so while that is expensive, in some ways, I believe Oregon is safer. But we do need to take a hard look, as you have said, at these things and see what we can do to improve the system. So thank you. Any other questions? Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker. My name is Kimberly Elaine. I'm the Executive Director for St. Vincent de Paul Society here in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And for the last 4 years, I've spent working with community corrections in Marion County to put together what we now call the Marion County Reentry Initiative. And we work with the Department of Corrections also to align systems. And this is really important. You've passed Senate Bill 267, which is an evidence-based practices bill that really focuses on what works. And here in Marion County, we've been spending a lot of time really looking at how to turn criminality and the generational cycle around so that we're not constantly funding and expending resources in ways that are not helpful for the community, and we're not growing as a community. One of the things that we've done is with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Parole and Probation, and nonprofits and other organizations in the county lining up resources. So we actually go into the Department of Corrections prior to release, working with the reentry coordinator of the releasing institutions, talking with folks that are going to be released to Marion County. And this is really important because most of these folks are coming back to the community. 93% of those that are incarcerated are going to come home. And the question is, how prepared are we for them coming home, and how prepared are they for coming home? And so that marriage of preparedness has to take place at some point. And these bills, all three of them, assist in making that interconnection happen. And it's really important because evidence-based practices says people that are motivated to change, we can assess for that. Let's see where they are, and let's target our resources around those who are medium to high risk to reoffend. Focus our resources there. Let's utilize what works. So these bills that are before you today focus on those practices. Education. Are they doing programming inside? Are they demonstrating completion and discipline to get those things done? Are they participating in programs such as cognitive behavioral programming, which actually the evidence says is one of the most effective things that we can do, is education, cognitive behavior, because that helps us rethink about, change their patterns of behavior. Their thinking is different. And one of the things we did here in Marion County is a jail study. It's like, what is this revolving door doing? Who's involved in that? And a large percentage of these folks, a very large percentage, are parents. And we have to break that generational cycle. If the parents being released are not educated in value education, if they're not motivated to change, if they're not participating in programming, that next generation is going to be right behind them. The time to do that is inside the institution with community support, making that linkage prior to coming back into the community. So when we take businesses, we take community partners, we go inside, we meet with folks. How prepared are you? What's your work history? What's your education? What's your programming? How are you demonstrating that you've got a plan for when you come out? and let's work on that plan together prior to release so those linkages are made. This is very, very important to bring down the cost of incarceration, to decrease criminal behavior and increase public safety. And really what's really important is that we begin the restoration of individuals and families so that now they're contributing members to our society and not taking from our society. So I really encourage you to look at these bills and other things that meet those goals, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'd like to add that Director Williams is working now. They're setting up a program for people who are veterans, because there are some veterans programs that they may be able to access, which helps them. And there are some more bills coming down to help people coming out that would, for example, provide tax credits to employers so they can help hire them so they have a job and some stability there. And we're also trying to put money into Head Start, which is kind of a few years earlier, but we'll hopefully have some of the same results you're talking about.
Those are critical, absolutely critical for this to work. Okay. So thank you very much.
Any other questions? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, along with that was the fact that we recognize, and we did 57, for instance.
That's right.
The value of drug court, and the one thing we're not getting to is mental health, because most of those people, about 70%, need mental health needs. And here again, if they've got a job, they've got training, the next thing is housing. They've got to have housing. Otherwise, they go back with the same people they came from. It costs less over the long haul to address all those things before they get out, because it's $58,000 to put them back in each time you do it. So also, there's a little thing called reuniting families has more value to it than we recognize.
Agreed, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger. We invited everyone to our grand opening of our 12-bed transitional housing facility just for this purpose. It is working with those reentering the community, particularly targeted around these initiatives. And the other issue around mental health, as noted, is to look for the ability to have prescribers that would actually work with us in the community and with those coming out of incarceration, so that we have that connection inside outside, so people can become stabilized. So I thank you very much for that consideration.
And we just had a tour that not everybody's able to go to of Coffee Creek, where they have a lot of they have a Head Start program. They have other programs, and where the parents have been in prison, daughters in prison, now the grandparents are raising the next batch to come to prison, and they're trying to break that cycle, and it looks to me like they're doing a very good job there. So
one of the areas of focus, Mr. Chair, is that we need to start working on our men. We're doing some great work at Coffee Creek around parenting and preparing keeping those solid relationships. And one of the things that we're pushing really hard is around developing programs with a male focus on how to be a responsible parent and role model.
They do have those classes going as well, and they're both of those classes are backed up with people waiting, applicants waiting to get into the programs. They just don't have room yet, and they're trying to expand that. But during these budget times, it's tough. Representative Smith.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for, I want to hold everybody to the same standard, but thank you for stuff that offered some data. That's really valuable to me. The one of my critiques as I enter this process is that without more, we are left with an unsatisfying battle of ideology, which generally speaking, all of us sort of line up on the same side of preferring law and order over preferring those who violate it. But ultimately, I think we're all also on the same side of just wanting there to be less crime. And if we can get past, and I'm saying this partly the record, partly our collective memories, if we can get past the culture wars of my parents' generation towards a data-driven, sense of how do we just make our communities safer, I think we'll be better off. And so I want to say thanks for this and then make a plea for one thing. And the plea for that one thing is that I heard some good data, I won't go through it all, about recidivism rates for those who receive treatment, for property criminals who receive treatment. Or excuse me, property criminals who don't receive treatment. We don't have accurate recidivism rates for property criminals who do receive treatment. We know that 85% of drug criminals are subject to some sort of substance abuse. Mm-hmm. Okay. We know that the recidivism rate for those folks is 55%. Mm-hmm. We know that only 12% of them get treatment. We know that the recidivism rate for the general population is, you know, 28%, I think it is. What we don't know is the magic number, and there are those who speculate it's like 18 to 20%, but it'd be really valuable information to know what the recidivism rates are for property criminals subject to substance abuse who do receive treatment. Us getting better data on this stuff helps us make better decisions, and I'll shut up.
And I know that, Representative Smith, I know that we're working on that, particularly around Measure 57 in that targeted group.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ginger Martin and Tom McClellan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV administrator, and I'm here to speak to one of the three bills. Ginger's here for three, so I'll start first.
Okay.
And cover that. I'm here to speak on House Bill 2489. The bill would require the Department of Transportation work jointly with the Department of Corrections to adopt rules to assist inmates in obtaining a driver's license or an identification card prior to being released from one of the state prisons. Just as some background for you, I am also a member of the Governor's Reentry Council. I've been working for a little over a year on these types of issues, and it's widely recognized that inmates who leave the prisons with state-issued ID cards are more likely to succeed because they're able to obtain jobs, get housing, open bank accounts, those types of things, and we recognize that. I've been working with the Department of Corrections for quite some time to help to ensure that inmates, as they're released, have the documents they need to help them obtain a driver's license or an ID card, such as a birth certificate or a Social Security number document with that, to be able to prove their identity and to be able to pass at least the initial steps of getting a driver's license or an ID card. But beyond that, and that's really after they leave the institution, what else can be done before they leave the institution? That's what we've been working recently in earnest with the Department of Corrections on. We've explored several options, and just to share with the committee, we've landed on ID cards as the document of choice in this situation rather than a driver's license. And I just want to cover some of the barriers to overcome with a driver's license versus the ID card, such as inmates who've never received an Oregon driver's license may have had their driving privileges revoked or have had a license that's expired for more than a year, have to get an original driver's license, which means they have to go through a knowledge test, a vision test, and a behind-the-wheel test, a drive test. That's a little difficult when they're still behind bars in the institution. Some problematic, practical types of issues to deal with. Many inmates have suspended driving licenses, and so we need to do some checks to even determine if they're eligible to get a replacement license issued to them. Eligibility requirements for the driver's license may include fines, working with the courts to clear outstanding suspensions, providing proof of insurance, providing a DMV clearance letter maybe from another state, paying a $75 reinstatement fee. But there's a lot of factors to be looked at there. We have recently worked with the department on ID cards. What could we do, at least on a limited scale, to try out some of the things, to learn a little bit more about this population and what their needs are and how the systems might work. The pilot that we are starting this month is a limited pilot with one institution, one prison, and one of our field offices to have anywhere from 5 to 10 inmates come to the office prior to opening, before the general public arrives, to handle the review of the documents, the photo process, collection of fees, those types of things. Our plan is to run this for 6 months and do an evaluation at the end of that period of time, both from our side, from a DMV perspective, and also for the Department of Corrections. Has it had any effect? Can we track the individuals to see were they more successful in reentering after they left? The Department of Corrections will ensure that all the inmates have the proper documents ahead of time, so we'll do some checking ahead of time. Proof of legal presence in the country, a birth certificate is an example of that, identity, date of birth, residence address, social security number. As you probably know, there's been a lot of change in the last year in the eligibility to get a driver's license or an ID card, and if nothing else, it's made it more difficult for this population to obtain a driver's license for different reasons, but it has made it more difficult. So there's more of a process involved than there used to be. The photo taken at the time of the individual's visit to our office will be compared to their most recent photo on file if they've been issued previously. That would be done in the office. If they pass all that process, a fee would be paid. And then overnight, we run all new photos against our entire database of photos. We call it facial recognition. We may identify some individuals who've done some identity theft if they haven't been convicted in the past by running that new photo against our entire database. That would also cause them to not be eligible for issuance of another card. So we may have to pull those out of the process and deal with those separately. After all this has been completed, we mail cards today. You don't receive the card in the field offices anymore. It's mailed from a central location. We will mail the permanent card to OSP's records office. They'll keep the card in a secure location until the day of the inmate's release. So it'll be part of their materials that they walk out of the prison with, that they can use in the community. So just in summary, we recognize this as a problem. We are working with the Department of Corrections today. We'll try out this pilot, see what we learn. In the meantime, we're looking at other states, see what they have done in this area as far as opening the equivalent of DMV field offices within prisons. There's a lot of issues to be dealt with there. Mobile units have been looked at. There's security issues and costs that we'd have to take a look at. But we are exploring those options. We're not prepared to bring those to you today. But what we're going to try is this pilot of transporting a few inmates to our offices to see if we can get at least that process to work.
Thank you. Committee, why don't we have questions for Mr. McClellan first? McClellan, please. Any questions for Mr. McClellan? Ms. Representative Stigler.
Yeah, I guess that you anticipate a lot of my questions. They were logistical concerns, knowing full well, first of all, that a lot of these folks either are not going to have driver's licenses that are valid or they've been suspended. So I'm glad to see that the focus is more. First of all, I'm glad to see that you're ahead of the curve anticipating some of this, and mm-hmm. you're really trying to get something going now. And secondly, I guess I would urge us to err on the side of providing documents that will be useful for them, but I don't want to say this, but rather than, you know, dwell on something like a driver's license that is probably going to be out of their reach for some time, something that they can utilize. And I would hope that that's sort of where we fall on this. And I wouldn't want to see any of these interagency agreements come down so that this group of folks, I think this is very laudable. I understand the lack of what happens because there isn't anything. But I would not want to see us any kind of interagency agreements fall on the side of affording them any kind of extra special rights that the ordinary citizen who's minded their P's and Q's would have available to them. So I would like to see us address the issue but not go too far afield. So.
Thank you. Representative Barden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McClellan, thank you for your testimony. I much appreciate it. And I appreciate the complexities that you enumerated. However, I'm wondering, actually, if all of that cannot and should not be accommodated via rule. As I read the bill, it seems that it's essentially, it gives significant delegation of authority to adopt rules. And the reason it does that, instead of addressing it in statute right here, is I think because it anticipates many of the complexities that you discussed. Is there anything based on your testimony that you oppose this bill as enacted or as written? It's unclear to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, we're just here to provide information.
I see.
I'm not opposed to the bill. If nothing else, to inform you that we are working along the same line with an agreement being developed for a small pilot, albeit small, and we haven't found a need yet for administrative rulemaking around this. It's more working with our existing systems and processes to achieve some of the desired ends, but we haven't need any rulemaking. So just more to inform you that we are a long ways along in this relationship and this working together.
Thank you very much, Mr. McClellan. Mrs. Martin, you're going to speak to all three bills?
Yes.
Thank you.
I am. Chair Resnick, members of the committee, I'm Ginger Martin, an assistant director with the Department of Corrections responsible for the Transitional Services Division, and I'm here to provide information on all three bills in much the same vein that Mr. McClellan did. I wanted you to know where we are in terms of implementing the outcomes that were desired by each of these pieces of proposed legislation. Mr. McClellan covered our pilot program pretty well. The only thing that I would add in addition to that is prior to starting the discussions around the pilot with DMV, the department knew we needed to do a more comprehensive job getting the necessary identification documentation available for people in prison so that they have it in hand either when they go to the DMV office, before they leave us, or after. And so we now have processes in place to request birth certificates on everybody who comes into prison so that they have that document when they leave. And also we've just signed a memorandum of understanding with the Social Security Administration so that we can request replacement Social Security cards. So our goal is to have these kinds of identification documents available when people leave, which helps this process if we can get the process in place to get state identification cards prior to lease. That's certainly our goal. But barring that, they will have the necessary documents to go directly to the DMV office and to take care of that when they leave. Regarding House Bill 2490, this is the one that requires the Department of Corrections to provide documents at the time of release that verify work record, educational programs, and treatment programs. At this time, we are providing certificates for completion of treatment programs and for when a person completes an educational program or a vocational program. The bill also requires verification of work history. The department is currently developing a process that will document not only work history, but also the work skills and the work performance that we observed while they carried out jobs while they were incarcerated. Many people who are in prison have multiple jobs over the course of their incarceration and multiple supervisors. And so we really need to think through a consistent and organized way to collect this kind of information and present it in a way that's going to be useful to a prospective employer. We currently have a work group in place that combines our Measure 17 work crews, supervisors, our vocational programs, and the Prison Industries Programs, Oregon Correctional Enterprises. They have an action plan in place. They're mapping out a process that we plan to have in place by September to verify work skills. And then House Bill 2623, this is the bill that allows an inmate to earn up to a 60-day reduction in the term of incarceration for obtaining a high school credential or college degree. At the time of sentencing, inmates can earn up to 20% off of their sentence for appropriate behavior and participation in programs. So that is in current law. This bill, as I understand it, would create a new way to earn time credits, but it doesn't increase the total credits available. So we still have our 20% earned time availability. Currently, about half of the people who come into prison do not have a high school credential or degree. And of those, nearly half, or 46%, actually earn a GED while they're with us. We looked at the group that earned GEDs last year, and 40% of them were eligible for earned time. So only 40% of those currently earning GEDs would be able to take advantage of this 60-day time credit. Again, the judge has to make that possible at the time of sentencing. And then a portion of those individuals are already earning 20%. So I just wanted to give you a sense of the size of a number of people who might be affected by this additional provision. And really that's what I'm here to do, mostly just to give him information about.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ginger, for your testimony. Percentages sometimes rattle in my brain. Can we get, is there some numbers there? Because we're releasing, what, about 4,000 people a year?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, I knew I should have done that math. So it would be 40% of the 760 would be eligible. So if we just do really fuzzy math, that's so about 300 people per year might be eligible. And then of those, 8% of those would already be at the 20%. This is completely a guess, but I would say maybe half of those folks might be already earning 20%.
So maybe this may be applied to about 150 people a year, just give or take, so we're having numbers. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the question. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2489, 2490, and 2623. We don't have a fiscal, so we can't work them. Ms. Saville will be getting an amendment out on 2623 to fix that and or question. Next item today, we have some bills to be introduced, some LCs to be introduced. I'm going to introduce them in mass. We have opened a public hearing on LC 3184, 3021, 3305, 3008, 1672, and 2840. I accept a motion to adopt those as committee bills. You don't need to repeat the numbers?
So moved.
Okay. Representative Wisnant moves we adopt those as committee bills. Open a work session to do that. Representative Wisnant has moved the bills be adopted. Is there any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We're going to recess the committee today until 4:45 in case... Oh, I'm sorry. I have still another thing here. We have a work session on House Bill... Open a work session, House Bill 2318.
House Bill 2318 allows a person arrested for a traffic offense to have the arrest record expunged in certain circumstances. You'll recall we heard this back on the 28th of January. It has to do with setting aside a record of an arrest, particularly in DUI cases. We have an indeterminate fiscal and no revenue.
And if you recall, this is the case where there was some people were arrested, or several people were arrested, and there was no prosecution because the case wasn't there, and then they were unable to clear that off their record. This was to take care of the rare occasion when something like that occurs.
Mr. Chair, does that allow us to go back on those from not just the ones forward, but the ones past?
Motion filed on or after the effective date, so yes, you could file a motion for an arrest that's happened before this every year.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2318 forward to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
President also moves House Bill 2318 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call and roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson will be the carrier of the bill. No further business. I'm going to recess the committee until 4:45 today because this is the last day of bill introduction in case somebody has bills. If we, I don't know if we'll even be here for 2 minutes, but I'd appreciate if you just show up so we can have a quick look. If we have more bills to introduce, we'll get them in. Meeting adjourned. Or no, recess.